one. Rob Wolf, Andy Dees, how are you today?
Dude, just loving almost 8 weeks straight of no sun in Chico.
Yeah, episode 14, and I really feel like for at least seven of these, it's been raining.
I'm like super close to doing a Kurt Cobain here, so we may not get an episode 15. Fortunately, everybody's like, thank God. We crested over seven, possibly eight listeners, and then it was done. It finished on a high point. So.
Rob, I met quite a few people at your first nutrition seminar that listened to the podcast. So I'm confident that we're in double digits. Maybe not that far in double digits, but we're over the 10.
We might be as high as 11. That's true. And all of those people who attended the cert, all 95 of them, I paid them to be there. So.
Oh, Rob, I got a chuckle from my mom today when she was like, "Oh, people paid to see Rob talk?" Obviously, she doesn't know you. I'm like, "Sure, people came from Ireland." She's like, "Ireland? What?"
No one is more shocked than I am. I promise you. No, I'm hugely grateful. It was a ton of fun. A really, really good crew. I think probably about 50 or 60 of the folks had been up at our neighbors up at CrossFit Reading the day before and did the Kelly Starrett gig and just had a blast with that because Kelly is a genius at all things. And then rolled down to Chico and slummed with us on a Sunday. So it was a good time.
Rob, they were all there for you. Don't sell yourself short. You're an incredible slouch.
Thank you. That is straight Chevy Chase there, I think. So,
It is. It's because I read an article this week about how they were trying to resurrect the Fletch franchise, and everyone is scared to take it on.
That was good stuff right out of the gate. So.
Well, anything you want to say about, this is episode 14, but it's the one after your seminar. So I feel like, is there anything else you want to say about, the first official Paleolithic Solutions seminar?
Oh man,
On the spot.
upwards of a 50% of the material was new. We covered cortisol pretty in depth. Usually, when I've talked endocrinology before, I'll mention cortisol kind of peripherally, but this time we had a whole section dedicated to it, and I think it just fleshes out a bunch of problems. And it's interesting, like the more and more I play with this stuff, there's just huge synergy between insulin regulation or dysregulation, cortisol problems, and that can range from like sleep disturbances to food intolerances to work-related problems. I mean, it's really insane how heavy that whole cortisol stress axis is. And then, of course, the whole leaky gut autoimmune response. Like I had a guy in the audience that was pretty familiar with the fact that like NSAIDs and some other anti-inflammatory over-the-counter products actually worsen gut permeability, which we're actually going to talk about leaky gut here in just a little bit. But that was a new chunk for me. But I felt like the material was pretty solid. I already have some ideas for how to tweak it and hopefully improve it a little bit. The feedback was solid. The most consistent feedback I've had is that people want a 2 day gig, which I just can't imagine doing back to back 2 days. I've done that before, but doing that on a consistent basis, I think would be rough. We're definitely working on a advanced topic piece, hoping that Matt Lalonde gets in and is working on some stuff for Lauren Cordain, and he would be hitting more of the like MD, PhD, nurse practitioner deal, and then I would just be peddling my pseudoscience to the peasantry, as it were. So it was fun and definitely good feedback from folks, but generally the thoughts seemed to be that folks got something out of it and it was worth polishing a chair in Chico with their fanny for 8 hours. So good times.
And another positive note, Rob, people think you're funny with your seven listeners. So I feel like you're funnier maybe than Nikki thinks you
My wife finds nothing I do funny, which is ironic that we marry those people, but it's also probably pretty good. So,
Couldn't resist. I'm sorry.
yeah.
A lot of caffeine today, my friend.
Lots of caffeine.
So cool. Well, congrats, man. I think it was a great weekend. We had sun shining, so those folks that don't frequent Chico probably think the weather's nice this time of year, but as I'm learning, it's not.
It's
But
not.
we'll deal with that.
Yeah, you coming from Arizona, you're getting definitely the short end of the stick, but we'll do the best we can.
That's right. That's all we can do. All right, great. Well, The first question today we got actually from multiple sources, and this is another reminder about the intro to paleo episode that we need to record, Rob. But I gotta just gonna keep reminding you until we do it.
You organize all this stuff, man. You pull the trigger on that. Although I guess I need to put together the curriculum for it. So okay.
Well, I can take a stab, man. We'll resolve it after the call. So anyway,
okay.
Multiple folks have sent in inquiries, basically along the lines of, "What is leaky gut? How would I know? You know, basically, what are the symptoms if I suffer from gut irritation?" So I'm going to throw that out at you and see what comes back.
Well, leaky gut is, let's think about just for a second, the intestines, you know, just the whole alimentary canal from mouth to jaw. Generally, you know, we have the sense that we chew up food and food goes down the pie hole and then it hits our stomach, and, you know, we kind of have a sense of that whole scenario. And then after that, things, you know, thankfully go because we don't really want to think about it too much after that. But all this food, bacteria, viruses, all this stuff gets all broken down and homogenized, and we should theoretically absorb this stuff at the intestinal lining, the mucosal lining, the villi and the microvilli, the little structures in the small intestine. We absorb nutrients, and I go over this stuff pretty thoroughly in the seminars that I've done, both when I was doing for CrossFit, now when I'm doing my own gig, because a fundamental breakdown in the digestive process appears to be at the center of the etiology of all autoimmune diseases. And we characterize it as leaky gut and the autoimmune response. But this whole leaky gut process, think about the intestinal contents are pretty nasty on their best of days, and we want to keep that stuff typically well isolated from the rest of us. And part of that process is, if you imagine, like if you were to interlace your hands and just really push the fingers together tightly, you could seal everything up. Say like you could hold water in your hands, but then it would not be very hard pulling the hands apart a little bit, get some kind of gaps and fissures in your hands, such that it would be very easy for some water, some, you know, like sand or something, to work its way through the gaps. And this is very, very similar to the way our cells go together. They're actually wedded together with these things called gap junctions, and there's kind of a cement, kind of tissue cement that glues all that stuff together. And grains, legumes, elements of dairy, some other things like you know, nightshades, tomatoes, potatoes, plants, some other things like alcohol and this weekend, NSAIDs being non-steroidal anti-inflammatories like Tylenol, ibuprofen, naproxen type stuff. Those things can all weaken junctions in which the cells of our intestinal lining meet together. And when those junctions are weakened, then it's possible for intact food particles, bacteria, viruses, all that sort of stuff to make its way into our system. And this is a potential route for the development of autoimmunity. Another way that this can happen is a viral or similar infection in the gut, which actually causes some damage to the gut lining. Like the gut lining starts shedding very, very quickly, and there's lots of fluid released, and typically there's diarrhea associated with it. And so this is kind of a food poisoning or you know, some sort of a they call all these things enteropathies when the gut lining gets irritated. But this is the etiology of leaky gut, and it can manifest in a ton of different ways. You know, like the question is, how would you know that you have it or that you suffer from it? And you can have some overt symptoms, like people will have irritable bowel syndrome, where they can rotate between points of constipation or diarrhea. They can have gas and bloating. They can have a ton of different stuff. There's a bunch of neurological symptoms. You know, people get foggy headed. Some kind of autism type things are very much associated with leaky gut. But the thing is that for a lot of people, they've possibly been like this their whole life, and so they never really have a sense of what, you know, normal or a healed gut feels like. And so this is why I'm kind of a wacko on this count of recommending people get in and fully eliminate all, you know, grains, legumes, dairy, possibly even some of these other problematic items like nightshades. The more that we learn about NSAIDs, really, the nastier that stuff turns out to be. It's interesting. Anybody suffering from arthritis, what's one of the main things that they're shooting down the pie hole? But ibuprofen. And if the underlying cause of the arthritis is already leaky gut, then it's just kind of a horrible downward spiral. So, you know, how do you know you suffer from gut irritation? Well, pull out all the gut irritating foods, see if you look, feel, and perform better, and then plug them back in and see how you do from there.
So, since you used the term nightshades, I don't think we've defined it, so why don't you go ahead and define that as well? Because I think that's going to be, that's sort of the next question. Well, you talked about nightshades. Okay, I haven't heard that term. What is that?
Tomatoes, potatoes, eggplants, it's stuff that we would otherwise kind of throw into a fairly good category, nutrition-wise and whatnot, but these things are all new world plants. And what we find is that there are some folks that are particularly sensitive to tomatoes, potatoes, eggplant. All of these items have, apparently tomatoes, I think constituent is tomatin. The stuff in potatoes is a kind of a saponin type product, but all of these things apparently have some gut irritating potential. I personally feel like I'm kind of like the canary in the coal mine, and I've never really noticed that much problem from like tomatoes, hot food, other than just hot food giving you hot food response. I eat it at 6 p.m. and at 3 a.m. I'm upping the mood because it's just hot curry or hot Thai food or something like that. But on a broader scale, I don't notice the same types of problems that I do if I get some sort of a gluten dose. So I've historically been a little bit not as aggressive in going after that stuff. Partially, and this is some of the stuff even talking about like nuts and seeds when we're talking kind of paleo nutrition and all that, people just get blown out of the water. And so it's kind of introducing the things in the order that's most important, I feel. And also most beneficial with like the removal of the nuts and seeds, potentially looking at nightshades just kind of being something down the road. So that and the main people that would be a concern for someone who has some serious systemic inflammation, like the joint achiness, some sort of a borderline autoimmune deal going on, or maybe a diagnosed autoimmune deal, I would definitely look at nightshades as being a problem in that whole scene.
All right, good. Paleo 101, Rob, it's got to be done.
We got to do it. And it needs to be pretty thorough. That may actually be like a two-part gig because it's going to be fairly lengthy. But yeah.
Right, good. Next, we got a question from Carlos. Carlos says, any suggestions on what girls can eat prior to and during their menstrual cycle that can curb their cravings for sweets? According to them, they're able to maintain their diet really well any other time, but the sweet cravings intensify during or before their menstrual. Any paleo sweets that you can recommend or any other recommendations?
85% dark chocolate seems to be a real good fix. I think to some degree it's, people get a lot of satisfaction out of that. And I think, in a good, better, worse kind of scenario, I think like dark chocolate is pretty damn good, all things considered. Obviously, if you eat a pound of it at a shot, it may not be all that great, but I think people get a lot of satisfaction out of it. You get some very good quality chocolate, you get some antioxidants out of it, you get some theophylline and theobromine that releases dopamine in the brain and makes you feel all in love and all that stuff. I think that's a pretty good option versus trying to like spackle together like some blackberries with honey or something. Just doesn't, if that's more your gig, I guess go for it. But I just wouldn't be afraid of doing 2 to 4 ounces of dark chocolate a couple of days a week during your menstrual cycle, if that's really what you've got going on. Some people, however, will not come back from that, and they're just going to end up spinning out and having problems. And the thing that I address with that is the Kelly Starrett, best self-defense, best self-defense, don't be there. So it's, keep your house pristine. If you know, or if the female is starting to get some cravings related to that stuff, go out, hit Trader Joe's or a good, a supermarket, get some quality chocolate, dark chocolate being preferable, the higher the cacao content, the better, and just go to town on that.
And I got an email a couple weeks ago from my friend Gabe from high school that actually listened to this, and he said they'd experimented with his wife with some of the homemade coconut milk ice creams during her menstrual cycle, and even played with adding a little bit of flavored whey protein. I've always experimented with whatever, blend up strawberries with the coconut milk and freeze it that way, but they seem to have reasonable good success with it, so.
That sounds good. Sounds pretty good to me too. I just, I would just not sweat, a meal or two here and there, or even three or four of them in the course of an otherwise pretty dialed in nutritional experience. I just wouldn't sweat that stuff all that much.
Sure. Unless you're like me and you just never come back.
Exactly. Exactly. Or like my wife who bought Trader Joe's had these, dark chocolate lovers chocolate bars. This is stuff that Lou was eating, like a Lou Mars, throughout most of his event, and they're really, really, really good. It's one of the only dark chocolate bars that I found good enough. Like usually, I can kind of take or leave the stuff. This stuff is good enough that I'm like, I wouldn't mind having a bar of that around. So we'll get two or three bars of it, and then like Nikki's like the mouse, I hear this scurrying downstairs, and then crack, crack, crack. Nibble, 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 and then a day later everything's gone. I'm like, dude, I didn't even get a bite of that stuff. So, yeah, that is, people may definitely spin out on that stuff if it's right underfoot. So.
Yeah, I did steal one of those from the Lumars event, and it was phenomenal, and I ate it all in one sitting, so
Shocker. Yeah. But
will not be buying those again.
the funny thing though is like one of those bars, like they end up having two bars per package. But one whole bar only ends up having like 12 or 13 grams of sugar in it. And so it's a lot of chocolate because the cacao content is so high, it just by necessity drives the sugar content down. So that's one of those things where if you really do choose some good quality chocolate, you end up getting a lot less sugar and you really, really enjoy it. It's pretty damn yummy.
Sure. All right. Second question from Carlos. Can paleo eating affect your menstrual cycle in such a way that your menstrual can be late or stop altogether? I asked all the obvious questions, such as, are you pregnant? Have you had any issues in the past? Are there any health issues? And the answer was no. Everything was fine until she started eating paleo. She's in her fourth week of paleo eating. Any ideas on why this might be happening?
Usually we see some return to normal on the whole paleo gig. Like when folks start eating more protein and more fat, we actually tend to see them able to run both lower in calories and lower body fat percentage, but still showing a normal menstrual cycle. Like I'm not really too sure why that would be. She might need some more fish oil. She might need a little more iodine. I mean, I'm not sure. It's a little bit counter to what I would normally see in that whole scenario. But that said, and this is just going to be kind of a wacky, controversial thing to throw out there, but women really aren't designed to have 6,000 menstrual cycles in their lifetime. Like I definitely, kind of subscribe to that. And like if you look at some of the evolutionary biology stuff, you check out like Lights Out, Sleep, Sugar, and Survival, and then the follow-up book, Sex, Lies, and Menopause, you get a pretty good picture that females, normally they would have become, they would start their menstrual cycle somewhere between the age of like 12 and 15 or something like that. And then you could probably expect that normally they would have gotten pregnant within a year or two after that. And then the thing is that when we have a normal, normally fed human being, a female gets pregnant, so you've got 9 months, let's just to make round numbers, let's just say a year of pregnancy, and then you've got about 3 years of breastfeeding under normal circumstances. So you've got between a 3 and 4 year normal birth spacing for most women. Now, the reason why breastfeeding now does not protect women from getting pregnant is because their body fat level is higher, their estrogen content is higher, and the estrogenic effect of insulin makes it such that women are hyper-fertile, particularly in their younger years. And so this is why normally a female would not be able to get pregnant again until the child is weaned and is 3, 4 years old and off running around on their own, because it just wouldn't work in anything but at a agrarian society sort of thing. So when you start looking at all that stuff, then women normally would have had only 100, 100 or so menstrual cycles throughout their lifetime, instead of like 400, 500, 600, like what they can have now. And so there are some, people get real freaked out about like the female triad and all that sort of stuff. And you see this in distance athletes, and they have bone demineralization problems and all that. That's not what I'm talking about, but just kind of throwing it out there for folks to consider. Like, it's maybe not the worst thing in the world that female not have normal menstrual cycles occasionally, particularly in an athletic kind of state. And I know I'm going to get burned and my head stuck on a pike for even suggesting that. I get that there's the whole female triad deal, and there's a bunch of like seriously fudged up food practices, anorexia, bulimia, all that stuff that leads into some of this other stuff. That's not what I'm talking about, but I just got to throw it out there that sometimes like normal state is okay, that is an okay thing to happen.
I'm not going to touch that one, Rob.
And that's why the podcast died at episode 14, because Rob and Andy were both killed. So,
You're on your own on that one. But those are excellent book recommendations. I'm on board.
yeah, I would just encourage folks to give that stuff a read. But then again, back to Carlos's question, I don't really know why she's responding that way. It might not be that big of a deal, or it may be something really atypical. And I'm sorry that that's such a nebulous statement, but we have 10 women in our gym right now who are pregnant. So, like, the whole paleo working out thing seems to be very, very good for fertility. So,
Yeah, I think the only thing I would add that I've seen like once or twice is a couple folks that got super underfed, eating paleo because they weren't hungry, and that seemed to have some impact on their menstrual cycles.
that could be totally.
So,
Yeah.
food for thought. Yeah. You didn't provide a final answer, Rob. I'm really upset right now.
It's a cliffhanger. We'll leave it for episode 15. If we haven't been killed by a group of really angry kind of feminist chicks, then we'll come back in and we'll shore it back up. So,
Fair enough, fair enough. All right, next we got a question from
Andy just wants to move out on a wall.
the train is off the tracks right now.
Yep.
Next we have a question from Derek, who actually holds the record for the most questions in queue at one time right now.
Yeah, it's
So
like 600 questions currently.
maybe not 600, but it's close.
Yeah.
594. So first part of Derek's question, this question. Dr. Richard Johnson says fructose, not starch, makes people obese. Thoughts?
That's a nice hand grenade to throw in. I think there's a lot of truth to that. We currently on the blog, there's been some commentary about like there's the dude that had the no BS, the no bullshit site, and he was taking Gary Taubes to task and all this stuff, and we kind of shot some holes in that. And then the issue about like the Katavans pops up, and it's like, well, they eat a 60% carb diet, don't seem to suffer any deleterious effects from that, but until they start introducing grains. And then when they introduce grains, they're eating the same amount of carbs, but it's a different type of carb. And then we start seeing some insulin resistance in these people. And then it's theorized that there's some sort of like leptin issue, in which the lectins from the grains, legumes, dairy, whatever it is they're getting, end up causing some sort of a leaky gut autoimmune response that ends up buggering leptin signaling, and leptin being the primary hormone that kind of neurotransmitter deal. It's produced in the fat base, but it's produced elsewhere in the body too, that tells us whether or not we're hungry. And it appears that if we lose our leptin signaling, we don't know that we are overfed, but yet we still want to eat more. And so those are all, kind of interrelated things. And then at the top of that deal is kind of fructose. Now, fructose, if you really get into it and look at it, fructose is a ketone sugar. Glucose is what's called an aldehyde sugar. Saying that, people are now going to be like, oh, I can eat fructose and be in ketosis, and I shouldn't have even said it. I should have thought this through more, but I already said it. The point of the matter is that fructose metabolizes in the liver very, very differently than starch. than glucose polymers. Starch is made up of glucose beads, essentially strung end to end, and glucose-containing items tend to fill the glycogen in the muscles, whereas fructose-containing items tend to fill the glycogen in the liver. Also, fructose tends to cause some other not nice liver transformations, very, very similar to consuming alcohol. And if you look at our ancestral diet, we probably, about the only time of year that we would normally get a good dose of fructose would be late summer, early fall, when there's actually more fruit around. And it's really interesting because that fructose causes almost immediate pronounced insulin resistance, which when the insulin levels start going up, then sex hormone binding protein goes down, our androgens go up, our fertility goes up, and our fat base all go up. And it's the perfect time for, making babies. And then you go into a winter that is largely more ketogenic and lower in calories and lower in fructose. So like I think that there's a lot to that, like this notion that fructose is very, very strong at the heart of obesity and fat gain and whatnot. And just within our stable of athletes and like the folks that we've worked with online, folks notice that if they peel out things like just whatever fruit, apples, oranges, bananas, or whatever, and they go more like yams, sweet potatoes, squash for their carbs, they tend to run leaner. They tend to be more insulin sensitive. So I think that there's a lot to
That was 2.5 minutes.
that. Was that too long, or do you want me to go longer on that?
You could draw your own conclusion for that. No,
Okay,
just
okay.
kidding. No, good answer. Next part from Derek. Are onion and garlic allowed on the paleo diet? I hate the word allowed, by the way. I have read many positive things about how they are both potent antioxidants and anti-inflammatories, but they seem a bit harsh or pungent. I want to say spicy. If peppers are questionable, perhaps these are too.
There are a lot of people that develop allergies to garlic, particularly in conjunction with wheat or dairy. And garlic can be a little bit of a GI irritant, but it can also be—it's really potently antimicrobial. I forget what it's the allicin gets hydroxylated or oxidized into an active form. So basically, like garlic needs to be crushed for it to become active. Like it needs to be exposed to some oxygen, and then you get a little bit of a ripening process with the whole. Active constituents in it. It's one of those things that I think it's great for some people, not so great for other people. I do really well with garlic if it's cooked well, like throwing it in soups and stews and all that. If I do too much raw garlic, like kind of a pesto sort of gig or something, it can make me a little gassy, little bloated. So I that's just the thing with garlic, onions, and it's interesting.
Rob. Rob.
Did I drop out?
You did. I don't know what happened.
Uh-oh.
You were attacked. Nah, it's probably the weather.
It could be. Where'd you lose me at?
I lost. You started to say something interesting about garlic, so I don't know. Just start wherever you think you want to start, and we're gonna edit out that minute or
Oh,
so.
okay. Well, garlic, you know what? The long and short of it is that garlic generally has some really good beneficial properties to it, as do onions. Both, however, have been implicated from various folks in different situations in being problematic with some GI problems. And so I would just kind of feel them out and see how you do with them. I notice for myself, I do fine on either of them and in large amounts so long as they're cooked. If I get too much of them raw, I have some kind of GI disturbance from them.
Yeah, and I think this you touched on a little bit in the first question, kind of about leaky gut. I think there's sort of a period of adjustment. You probably start removing certain things like wheat, dairy, And then as you get further down the road, more refinement. Think about the nuts. You can maybe play with some of these. Obviously, if you have autoimmune issues or something, you're going to attack this from a little bit different angle. But I think for the average person, I don't spend a lot of time worrying about onions or garlic.
No, definitely not.
Dig in. And the last part of Derek's question, which I actually wanted to touch on because I thought this was actually an important topic. He says, "You guys won't come back in 40 years and say that tomatoes are perfectly fine to eat, will you? I feel like this stuff happens all the time in nutrition."
Well, okay, so the one thing that I was going spinning out on when and maybe this is why the phone pooped out is the whole like allowed thing on the paleo diet. Like I it is it would just horrify me if what we're doing turned into another cult, just another like goose stepping, unquestioning cult. Like we've got enough of that. We don't need any more of that. We need people who are thinking and using general guidelines to like hopefully just live a better life. And I think that hopefully that's the way we try to present this stuff. There are some generalities, like one of the things that I definitely will dive in front of a bus and be like, for the love of God, don't do it. It's like, don't eat gluten, in general. Like I can pretty much hang my hat on that. And then from there, it starts getting a little bit more, not as granular or whatever. It's a little less clear what the exact buy-in is. And so the stuff like tomatoes, I eat tomatoes all the time. I don't seem to have a problem with tomatoes. If I had an autoimmune disease or somebody else has an autoimmune disease, I'm really going to counsel them to not consume tomatoes and see if that affects them beneficially. And I've worked with enough people who have had enough problems that they do seem to respond well to removing nightshades out of the lineup if they've got some sort of real inflammatory condition or autoimmunity. And so, I guess like the Eads, I would just want to reserve the right to modify things as I go if I understand things further. But I think that there's some three I think there are some generalities here that we get that are very, very consistent. One thing that is new is that I'm really being forced to reevaluate is how much dietary carbohydrate is good or optimum. And if you would have asked me 10 years ago, I would have been like, hardly any, green veggies, that's it. You don't need anything else. The other stuff won't benefit you. Advanced glycation end products, sugar sticking to your proteins, blah, 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 all that stuff. And I still probably about 90% buy into that. But then at the same time, some of this Catawba information is compelling. I mean, it's interesting. There are these well-documented situation of these folks eating a largely carbohydrate diet, 60% carb diet, and doing just fine on it. And it's again not grain based, and it's with the introduction of grains that they start seeing some problems. And this looks real, real similar to the whole Okinawan situation, which is a good hunk of protein, fats from marine sources and all that. And then a bunch of carbohydrate, largely from like yams and sweet potatoes, is what their ancestral diet has been. It hasn't been so much rice. So these are some commonalities that I've maybe modified a little bit over time. Is like, okay, maybe people do legitimately have some better operating parameters health-wise with regards to carbohydrate. I think the doc from PanU is very much of the opinion that it's like low carb, or is the lower the better to some degree. And I still, in my heart of hearts, kind of agree with that. But this Catawba stuff has made me try to rationally reevaluate what I'm looking at all this stuff and say, okay, maybe there is a more to it than what I've been thinking previously.
Yeah, and I think, this whole if we change our mind in 40 years reminds me of the whole Mike Boyle thing, like to your point about the Eads, reserve the right to change your mind. And if you're, we don't have the final answer, I don't think, on anything in any field. And if we're still doing exactly the same thing in 40 years and haven't changed our minds about anything, then Rob Wolf, you are the smartest man on the planet.
Exactly. Well, and it's if you look at like physics or something like that, where Newton developed a bunch of calculus and a bunch of the stuff that we used in mechanics and physics.
And some of that stuff was kind of new initially. Obviously, you cook up this new way of assessing, like movement and rate of change and all that sort of jive. But then pretty quickly, you kind of come to a point where you're like, okay, this kind of is what it is. And a couple hundred years can go by and mechanics really haven't changed all that much. And so then it's like, yeah, okay, we've used this stuff, we've explored it, and this is kind of the furthest reaches of it that we're going to see. Within the context of the paleo diet, like Cordain has these seven tenets of a paleo diet, based around macronutrient breakdown, protein, carbohydrate, and fat. And there's a spectrum on that, but it's not hugely divergent. There tends to be more consistency than not. Micronutrient density, the amount of vitamins, minerals, antioxidants that you get per calorie, acid-base balance, sodium-potassium balance, fiber content. I'm blanking on two other things. But anyway, like there's some basic tenets with that paleo diet that are in stark contrast to our modern diets. And I think that when you start looking at it from that perspective and you start analyzing health and wellness from that perspective, then we have some pretty consistent findings. Similarly, like the work that Frank Booth did with his exercise and gene expression, and this kind of dovetails into some of the work that Cordain and Boyd Eaton did early on, looking at hominid energy expenditure. We're wired up to be very, very active, but a variety of activity, and this is some stuff that Andy and I talked about I think last podcast, is a little bit more of that long, slow distance stuff mixed in with strength work, mixed in with what we would call metabolic conditioning, probably models the human environment a lot better than just like sitting on the couch and then doing Fran and then sitting on the couch and then doing Helen. It's all or nothing, and there should be a lot more in between ground on that. Art Devaney's talked about that for years, and so there are some things there where we've got some models that I think we can legitimately hang our hat on with this stuff. We understand and develop nuances to it, but there's some pretty solid stuff there that we can hang our hats on. And I still don't know where that places tomatoes.
Or carbohydrates.
Or carbohydrates in general. I don't know. I mean, there's some, I think there's some either, if A then B, or some either or type stuff, or maybe it's some sort of a spectrum going on there. I'm not really too sure. Some of the lights out argument is that the closer to the equator you live, the better your carbohydrate tolerance typically is. And I would 100% agree with that. And that very much makes sense. And it'd be nice. I've only seen a few people take some Chinese medicine and wed it to some of the Western stuff. Like Poliquin's done it a little bit. I've got 40 units of Chinese medicine diagnostics under my belt in my pseudoscientific background. And it's interesting when you start getting into like five element theory and stuff like that. Like it talks a lot about your body will kind of match itself to the environment in which you live in. And so if you live in a dry, arid environment, you will tend to adapt to that. And certain physiological types will have problems with that. Similarly, people who live in a damp, cold environment will have, problems and adaptations associated with that. And I think for sure when we start getting in a extended dark period, like when you live further north or further south towards the equator, basically a shortened photo period, you don't handle carbohydrate as well. There's no doubt about it. But then also, as you start going further and further, a higher and higher latitude, you just have less carbohydrate available too. You get more and more kind of ketogenic in the way that you just find foodstuffs around. So I think that's pretty interesting also.
We don't have an answer.
We do not have an answer. Just tons more questions and stuff to tinker with.
All right, Derek, we answered one question. 593 to go. I'm just kidding.
We'll get to those next podcast. We'll do the Derek's hit list podcast. So
moving on. Got a question from Ben. He said, "Hey Rob, love the podcast. You're the man, or caveman, as it were." I like that.
Boy. We need a Lumar's rim shot off of that. So
I vaguely remember you saying in an interview that ice baths increase insulin sensitivity. Could you elucidate how this occurs and what evidence supports it? Maybe a topic for the podcast.
I have no idea the mechanism with this. I read on it. We know that cryotherapy will, you know, like icing an area will improve. You get a vascular rebound response, one. So like when you ice an area, it will initially, you know, maintain the same color and then it will start turning red. You get a rebound hyperemia response where you get increased vascular flow to the area. And that contrast can actually suppress inflammation really, really effectively. On a systemic level, I have no idea what the mechanism there where it reestablishes insulin sensitivity. But I know I've read research on it where it does. We could try to drag, do some Googling on that, but also like a simple Google search is like a cryotherapy, insulin sensitivity, hydrotherapy, insulin sensitivity. There's a couple of things that you could look at and could track down some of the literature on it. But it works, and it works really, really potently.
That was an epic fail of a response, but we'll take it.
It's the best I have, damn it.
Sorry, I'm cranky today. It's late in the day. Too much coffee.
Never too much.
Yes, well, says you. Next, we got a question from Jason. Jason's been experimenting with a very low-carb diet, and I think he's in a happy place. He may be friends with Matt Lalonde now. He's going to be deployed in approximately 6 to 8 weeks, and the food that he will be exposed to will be pure and absolute. I'm not going to swear.
Shite.
Thank you. So he, in an attempt to take control of it, he's converted 22 kilograms of beef roast into beef jerky. I like this guy. And has his coconut milk and oil at ready for a dietary nasty onslaught. So anyway, his question is, how fragile is the gluconeogenesis keto state, what I call the happy place, just because of the incredible effects on a mood and body comp? Will 1 gram of refined sugar kick me out of it? At what point does my carb intake jeopardize the state? I guess I'm asking, if I do end up having a meal or week of meals which include refined carbs, how severely will I be affected? I know it takes 2 to 3 weeks to initially get into the state, and things get exponentially better from there. But what happens if you've been in that state and you're exposed to refined carbs? Does it take 2 to 3 weeks to get back into it, or is it a shorter process?
No, I mean, Matt Lalonde did a blog post on this, actually, and it one meal is not gonna, it'll bounce you out of ketosis, but it's not that damn hard to get back into it. And something to keep in mind too is you don't need to just eat carbs to go out of ketosis. You can eat a overly large hunk of protein and go out of ketosis, because the body will go into gluconeogenesis and it'll kick enough carbohydrate out so that you can go out of ketosis that way. I don't really sweat it all that much. I just kind of eat to satiety and kind of let all that stuff work itself out. Michael Eads is a big fan of what we would call hepatic glycogen repletion. It's a big long term for like letting your liver make carbohydrate out of protein sources. And it's very, very insulin regulated. It produces some glucagon, and folks always forget or don't understand that glucagon actually improves insulin receptor site sensitivity, so it makes insulin receptor sites work better. And so it all kind of comes out in the wash. I wouldn't really sweat it too much. It sounds like he's doing a hell of a job prepping for it, so I wouldn't worry one way or the other with that, really. Sounds solid what he's doing.
Yeah. That is a lot of beef jerky.
That is a hell of a lot of beef jerky. All I can say is if we ever do some sort of like Xterra event, Jason is going with us, and he is provisioning the whole freaking endeavor. So,
and hopefully I will not be on that trip.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. We promised never coach another endurance event. So after the Lumars gig.
You can consult Rob, not coach.
Yeah. Okay.
Cool. Next, we got a question from James. I guess he sent us an email last week but left a couple things out, so he's going to simplify and add at the same time. He's in a situation where he has practically no time and really only time for breakfast and lunch. He doesn't have access to the best carbohydrate selection as he's in the Dominican Republic. So the question is it all right to do intermittent fasting every day, as in eating only breakfast and lunch but getting all my zone blocks in? The other is, the one meal that I have after working out, should I not have my fat blocks there and up the carbs, or should I just do everything even? Any ideas you have on what I should do would be great. Thank you.
Wow. You know, that was It's always an eye opener for me when I travel much outside the U.S. or Canada or something like that, because when we were in Nicaragua, there just was not a lot of veggies to be had at the stores. Like, there was some, but not anything like what we're used to here. And there was actually a lot more fruit and all that sort of stuff as kind of the baseline availability. You still there, Andy?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Okay. I had a little click. I thought maybe the phone gods had kicked us off again. So, I mean, that's just kind of an interesting gig, and he's coming out of the Dominican Republic with all this stuff. I think it's totally fine to put all the zone, you know, if he's doing a weight-measured zone, sticking all those blocks into two meals, I think is totally fine. People do that fairly frequently. They seem to do pretty well with it. I think it would be hard as hell to, you know, a way to do it is just basically post-workout, you would have a larger protein and carb meal, and then the other meal would just be more protein and fat, and it would probably rotate based on whether or not you're working out. So you would use like 42 ways to skin the zone and figure out on your non-workout days, you could delete some of the carbs or a significant amount of them. And then on workout days, obviously have significantly more. And there again, you could play with that and just see to what degree you need the carbs to be able to operate well. You know, like Matt Lalonde and a lot of other people are showing there's a huge spectrum in which people operate well, and it may just be a matter of getting in enough fat in total to keep that engine turning over.
Yeah, I cannot imagine fasting each day and only eating zone. So.
Yeah, seriously. That was the other thought. Like, I'm hoping that you're at least at like 5x fat or something like that. Like, seriously, prop up that fat. I would prop up the protein blocks too. Like, I might even up it, you know, good 10 to, I don't know, 25%, maybe even. If you're a 16 blocker, I would stick it at like 20 blocks of protein or something like that, just to cover your bases.
Yeah, or maybe roll a few weeks and just don't weigh and measure it and keep up your fasting and see what happens. I'd be curious actually to see how much he actually ate, but I can't weigh and measure anymore either. It drives me crazy.
Pseudoscience, man.
It's all going to come out in the wash, Rob.
Yeah.
All right. Good question. Yeah, the whole veggies in some of the international locations is always interesting.
Well, and it, you know, why am I blanking on the Panu doc's name?
Kurt.
Kurt. Kurt had, you know, interesting point, and it's really interesting because it dovetails in real nice with what Eads talks about and all that, and they're just like, vegetables, you know, it's like, yeah, that's cool, but don't sweat it so much. And again, there again, you start sounding like crazy person recommending that or even giving notion to it. But I don't think we need quite the huge variety and all that we might have thought. You know, like some kale, some collards, beet tops, all that sort of stuff. That it's pretty solid. It doesn't need to be as spectacularly broad as what we usually shoot for. And usually the seasonal variation is pretty good to go on that when you get right down to it.
Yeah. Dr. Kurt Harris, which reminds me, he was on Jimmy Moore, Living La Vida Low Carb, a few weeks ago.
Oh, right on.
Yeah, highly recommend folks check that out.
You know, if you want to, we can do just a blog link back to that so that folks check that out. That would be cool.
That would be perfect. Good reminder, Rob.
Sweet.
All right, cool. Next question. Hey, Rob, a question I get from some of my clients when talking about a low-carb paleo diet is about carb loading before an athletic event. My understanding is that the only reason to do this would be to top off muscle glycogen stores, and that doesn't take that many carbs. So basically, carb loading isn't necessary or helpful. Am I correct in my thinking? In your opinion, should athletes be carb loading prior to events? Any input would be greatly appreciated.
What type of athlete, what type of event, how have they historically trained, how long is the event? I mean, you just can't give this is not a one-size-fits-all kind of scenario. Different people adapt to varying degrees on a higher or lower carb intake based on their work output. 10 years ago, I felt like I actually, and this could just literally be built within the whole context of 10 years ago, but I really seemed to motor along really, really well on just low carb, like tons of fat, lots of protein, no carbs at all. And I would do jujitsu, I'd do kickboxing. I just seemed like I never ran out of gas. Whereas now I think I do a lot more. But then I got to say also, I never did anything that was kind of CrossFit-esque. As hard as the jiu-jitsu was, as hard as the kickboxing was, it was never as hard as some of the longer CrossFit style wads, which will completely knacker me. And there's an understanding also that when you completely exhaust a muscle of glycogen, it takes a lot longer to replete it, to build it back up. So there's a bunch of different variables in there. And like the fundamental thing is you need to gameplay all of this stuff and figure out how the folks are going to respond. So you can't just go into game day and like bust out something new, either on the side of we're going to try it low carb or we're going to carb load suddenly. Like you need to practice that. You need to, you know, if the event is at 3 o'clock, then you need to figure out what your pre-meal fueling is. And you need to practice that several times to figure out like what the gastric emptying is and all that stuff. A paleo diet for athletes, which is oriented around endurance athletes, definitely shifts. It has some shockingly periodized blocks of training in which you have a period of time in which you're lower carb, higher protein, higher fat, and then you get into a competitive phase in which you use significantly more carbohydrate. You're taking advantage of a post-workout carbohydrate windows and stuff like that. People seem to do really well on that. Our guy Glenn Cardoza, the MMA fighter, did super well on protein, greens, and veggies for most meals. Protein and carbs in the form of sweet potatoes post-workout. He would weigh in for his MMA fights the day before and then do little, you know, easy kind of workouts, you know, like 2 rounds of Cindy and then eat a protein and carb meal. So technically he was kind of carb loading too, but we played with that stuff a bunch. So you just, there's no 100% answer. It's very situation dependent and you need to game plan it if you want to get it right.
This is not helping you sell your Rob Wolf pre-workout shakes that I...
Damn it!
Foiled again.
Yeah, maybe people can just rent the shake since they don't really know if they're going to need it. Although the return policy would be really gross. So,
oh man, all right, one size fits all, Rob. Remember that.
It does. I had a guy email me the other day, and he asked if he could post one of my the really big post workout nutrition blog post that I did. I don't know, it was maybe a year ago or something like that, and he wanted to put it on a bodybuilding forum. And I was just like, oh, mother of God. And I was like, yeah, go for it. And I'm just waiting for the kind of onslaught to happen with that, you know, because the bulk of the people I'm working with are kind of more CrossFit oriented, or at least, you know, more kind of strength and power oriented. So like outright muscle mass gain, although we talk about that stuff a lot and all of us pine to be as muscular and strong as Matt LaLonde and John Fragoso. But it still isn't like the meat and potatoes of what we do versus like in kind of a bodybuilding forum, you know, like that is it. That is the reason for being. So I was just like, oh man, I'm just waiting for where all that stuff goes. I haven't had any link back yet, so maybe it hasn't gone up yet. But you know, it's just there is such a potent desire for making everything like a one way, like a one size fits all, a one way kind of a approach to it. And there's just so many variables, so much individual variation. You have to keep some good concepts in mind and then just do a ton of tinkering based on your own composition and all that. And it you know, that's where the art of this stuff comes in. Like, you use as much of the science as you can, and that's where the art of just tinkering and seeing how it turns out, it is where it all kind of finishes.
And tinkering is going to dovetail nicely into our next question from Tiramisu.
Excellent. Great name, too.
I know. I was like, is that really, really the right name? Well, I don't know. Hi, Rob. I've listened to you use the phrase look, feel, and perform with regard to judging the impact of diet changes. I'm struggling with how you can see a significant enough change in these characteristics unless you are making a radical change from a deficient or allergic reaction to a healthy diet. Once you've tossed out the heavy hitters, processed sugars, simple carbs, got your macros gently worked out, and taken your basic multi, fish oil, vitamin C, D, E, how do you differentiate whether a dietary change is an improvement?
Geez,
give you the Greg Everett answer.
What's the Greg Everett answer?
I think he stole it from you, but I once heard him say, If you're living on donuts and orange juice, I can guarantee significant improvement. If not, we're going to have to tinker significantly.
That is true. That is very true. I mean, once you're at that spot, if you've done all that stuff, then you've kind of done everything you need to do. So I'm a little perplexed on this. So do you have a different take on
Well,
anything
and I
here?
don't know exactly what we're getting at here, but some of it reminds me, I've had this discussion with Scotty Hagness on some of the advanced Poliquin protocols and things. Like some of the stuff, after you get at a certain point down the road, I mean, what you're really looking at is percentage points of improvement or fractions of percentage points.
Right.
And I think for a lot of folks, I'm not sure that's really relevant. Depending on, your situation, your background, what you're striving for. We talked about the Lance Armstrong thing before with, measuring in a wind tunnel, positioning on the bike, for him, for that, fractions of a percent would make a big difference. For a lot of folks, I'm not sure that it even matters in the big picture, and things are going to come out in the wash.
So yeah, I guess that's a great way to delineate that, is just like how important is all this stuff to you, and also another thing to keep in mind, I made this point both at the Black Box Summit and at the Paleolithic Solution seminar deal. We talked about the performance that we got out of Glenn Cardoza and some people like John Fragoso, some of our better in-house males. But these guys, like Glenn has a 440, 460 fight gone bad, something like that. 275-pound clean and jerk, 225 snatch. He's 170, 175 pounds. His main deal isn't even working out. We just do that to make him a better MMA fighter, and he's phenomenal at that. And then the question comes, and he's done this unweighed, unmeasured paleo diet. And this question that I threw out to the Black Box Summit is Russ Berger that really took me to task. He's like, "Well, why wouldn't you weigh and measure his food? When would you weigh and measure Glenn's food?" And I was like, "What would you do specifically to improve what he's doing? Because he's making improvements every day. Every time he comes in the gym, he's either doing better with his Thai boxing or he's doing better with his O lifting. And so, like, what's working is working very, very well. And this is a guy who's written 13 books and, is a full-time fighter. And he's doing great off of the program that we're doing. Now, could he potentially get more juice out of it? Yeah, possibly, but I'm frankly at a loss as to say, okay, well, he needs more protein or more carbs or more fat. I mean, he seems to be doing really, really well with what he's doing. And so I would be remiss to tinker with any of that. And so this is another deal where if you're still making progress off of what you're doing, and if you have a smart program, you've got a little periodization in there, you've got some linear strength progression for most people. Most people are still weak enough that they need to be focusing on strength as kind of a primary factor, strength and technicality. I would put that caveat. And then if they have all this big stuff dialed in, they're probably going to be making some solid forward progress. And occasionally you'll find something like adding in like night calm, some extra magnesium, really, really improves sleep quality. Some people respond well to tribulus, and so they get a little boost in their testosterone production or something. But these are really, like you said, fractional improvements. And it's the big macro stuff that is usually the hardest but most important stuff to get people to focus on.
Yeah, and I think the only other thought I had reminded me of Dan John, philosophy of a strength coach. I've heard him talk about this a couple times where he has his standard few workout programs that he's used over his life and his standard diet. He would always say, when I'm going to play with adding something in, he uses fish oil originally as an example. If I do X workout that I've done a number of times and I'm doing it over a period of weeks, I generally know how I feel, 2 weeks in, 3 weeks in. And his approach is if I feel a significant difference, at 2 weeks, at 3 weeks, when I added something in like fish oil, said I'm going to keep it in. He's like, if I don't feel a difference, I'm gonna get rid of it.
Sure.
So I think that's one way to do it. I think some of the supplements you're talking about, like the vitamin D thing, I've talked to folks that notice a super immediate difference with that. I supplement with vitamin D, I never have noticed a difference with it, but I'm supplementing with it based on the fact that I believe the research and the theory of how critical it is, and in that case, I'm not necessarily relying on a change in how I look, feel, and perform.
Right. Yeah, I dig it. Yeah.
So, my 2 cents. I'll sell it to you for a penny.
Perfect. Bargain.
All right, good. Next qu couple questions from Daniel. What are your thoughts on krill versus fish oil? I now take krill because it smells less, no burps, and I can take a lot less for the same impact.
You know, the krill, honestly, it just makes me a little nervous because that stuff is like the base of the food chain of the ocean, and it just makes me a little nervous, like, harvesting all that stuff and eating it all. But then if we kill the ocean, then it'll really solve the global overpopulation problem and all the other damage we're doing to the planet. So maybe that's all fine. I think it's real good stuff. It's got it loaded with a zeaxanthin, astaxanthin, cryptoxanthin, all these like funky carotenoids that do some cool stuff. So I think it's legit. Like, it's definitely very, very good, but it does make me a little nervous on that, you know, soylent green side of things, where like we've killed the algae of the planet and we're all gonna die. So I don't know, but that's my only kind of big reservation about it.
Yeah, and the krill thing is interesting because one of the few folks whose stuff I love and respect that really like it is the Eats.
Yeah.
Most other folks that I've, you know, I'm really into their stuff, you don't hear much about it. So I've never really been able to wrap my head around that.
Yeah, he did also, however, turn his back on his excellent exercise chapter in which he advocated lifting weights, sprinting and jumping and throwing stuff, and then got in bed with Fred Hahn on the super slow gig. But he did make the point too that that's the only thing that he will do, and so it's better than doing nothing, which I fully agree. But
don't hate on the super slow. You're gonna start hating on the hit guy soon, Doug McGuff, you know. There's room for all of them, Rob.
I like Fred. Fred's a good dude. He's a good dude. He and I have had ton of email exchanges, so he's a good guy. It just kind of broke my heart a little bit when Doctors Eads turned their back on their I think that book is just amazing. Like, it is really the cat's meow as far as I'm concerned. I hope mine is worth a puddle of urine compared to theirs, but trying to make it solid. So,
and you're talking about the Protein Power Life Plan.
Protein Power Life Plan, just outstanding book. Yeah,
epic. Yes. And second question from Daniel. He says, you often say things like lean out. What do you define as lean?
I think for most people, it's usually having a little bit of abs showing. You know, and the reality is, like, if you're more, I think to some degree, the more legitimately athletic you are, that being like you have to do something against someone else or against a barbell or something and not just kind of figure-oriented stuff, then that level of leanness is not going to be as much as what we might otherwise think or want. So, like, you know, you can see people who get into the you know, 5% body fat level where they're very, very, very lean. Usually you start seeing that be counterproductive to overall performance, but it kind of depends a little bit too. But usually the abs are up, and in males that'll be about 10% or lower. Females maybe like 12% or lower. 13%.
Yeah. Or for me, 5%, whatever. No comment.
Andy D's large and lean.
And I think the lean out thing, I mean, it's relatively subjective depending on, you know, I think we got a couple questions about, like, hey, am I lean enough to start bulking? Am I, you know, are you happy with where you are? You know, for some folks, I think their goal is really that six pack, you know, or whatever, eight pack. I think for some folks, their performance is more what they're oriented to. And, you know, we see folks that are super, super lean often not excel depending on what sport they're playing.
Right, right.
So another spectrum. Oh,
man. Indeed.
All right, question from L.A. The final question, Rob. This could be the moderately almost the shortest since the first one. Hey, Rob, thanks for the fantastic podcast. Quick off-topic question. Can you gain fat if you eat more than your body weight in protein? I weigh 125, but when I recently put all my foods into Fit Day, I saw that I'm eating between 150 and 170 grams of protein today, per day. I have recently gained body fat. Could this be a culprit?
Could be. I mean, certainly if you're eating more than what you were eating previously, you know, protein does release some insulin. Obviously, you know, there's a point, and this is the stuff where, like, I think some people like Lyle McDonald and some other people start casting stones at the whole kind of paleo low carb camp, where they're like, you know, you know, it does come down to calories and all that stuff. And at some point, it's like, yeah, okay, it does come down to calories. But then miss a bunch of other points in which low carbohydrate level tends to cause a lot of satiety, and it tends to make it just very, very hard to even eat enough calories. And so there's like this whole mix mash deal with that. But fundamentally, if you're gaining body fat and you're legitimately gaining body fat, then it might be the caloric content, or it could be that you've been sleep deprived, or your stress level has gone up, or a bunch of other stuff too. So it could be that, but it can be other stuff too. We can start caloric restricting people and screw up their sleep, and they'll end up less lean, particularly through the midsection. So
sure,
yeah, but I mean that certainly is a good spot to look, but it's not just dependent on like whether or not it was more grams of protein than pounds of body weight. It could be the overall package. Maybe you need to dial down some carbs somewhere, maybe you need to dial down the fat so that the total caloric load is less. Maybe you do better on a recovery basis on higher protein. I don't know. I mean, it's all over the place on in that regard.
Good question
though. Yeah.
That's it, Rob. That's the end, man. Episode 14, maybe the last one ever.
People are begging, like, please let it stop. Call the police.
So before we close, though, I want to throw out there that, I was having this discussion at the gym about some classic 80s movies, things like Rad.
Oh, no.
Gleaming the Cube. And I told Rob, Prayer of the Roller Boys was like a classic movie, and he has no idea what I'm talking about. So if anyone listening has seen this movie, please respond on the blog so I can prove to Rob I'm not the only one who saw this movie in the 80s.
We can provide a link to the trailer too. It has some namers. It has a Corey Haim at his apex, Patricia Arquette, and she was very hot and delectable as she always is. I missed that one. Like, that was obviously like a bong exhale month for me or something like that, because that movie never hit the grid, whereas Rad and Gleaning the Cube definitely was a fan of that. But as much as I liked inline skating, that probably was not the bigger draw for me.
Oh, you're too busy lifting weights. I'm sorry.
I was too busy lifting weights. That was around my state powerlifting championship point, which I did track down the video on that, and I've got it transferred to AVI and to Flash, and I should be posting that soon. So it's horrible. It is a train wreck. So
I can't wait to see it. Actually, there was a couple of your friends from high school that were threatening to post pictures of you on the internet before you started lifting weights to show me how skinny you were. So I need to see some of those.
Well, I wonder if I was skinnier then than I am now. That's hard to imagine, but yeah.
So with that wonderful topic, Prayer of the Roller Boys, Rob, check it out, and I'll talk to you next week.
All right, sounds good.
All right, see you, man.
All right.